Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is poet, writer, and co-host of AM to DM for BuzzFeed News, Saeed Jones. He's joined in conversation by theologian and artist Marvin K. White. And now, join Maggie Grabmeier on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Saeed Jones and Marvin K. White.
Saeed Jones is a poet and the author of the celebrated Prelude to Bruise. He's a co-host of BuzzFeed's morning show AM to DM and previously served as BuzzFeed's LGBT editor and culture editor. He joins us tonight to talk about his new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives, an unforgettable coming-of-age story of a bookish, black, gay teen from Texas as he learns how his world sees him. Blending poetry and prose, Jones draws readers into his boyhood and adolescence, into tumultuous relationships with his mother and grandmother, into passing flings with lovers, friends, and strangers. Each piece builds into a larger examination of race and queerness, power and vulnerability, love and grief, a portrait of what we all do for one another and to one another as we fight to become ourselves. The book has gotten rave reviews, and the New York Times Book Review called it a moving, bracingly honest memoir that reads like fevered poetry. Saeed is joined by Marvin K. White, the minister of celebration at Glide Church in San Francisco. He's the author of four collections of poetry, Our Name Be Witness, Status, and the two Lammy-nominated collections, Last Rites and Nothing Ugly Fly. But first, let's please welcome Saeed Jones.
Thank you so much for being here. This is just a thrill for so many reasons, but also because I really believe your time is so deeply valuable. You know, there are so many things you can and should be doing in any one moment in America. And so using some of your time to spend it with me, thank you. So I'm so excited to talk with Marvin. I lived in San Francisco October 2012 to October 2013. And during that time period, it was a good time, good year, thank you. And during that time, we got to do a reading together. So this is a lovely kind of full circle moment. But before he comes out, I wanted to give us, you know, some tools that we can all use collectively tonight for the conversation. This is from really the climax of the book. It's the beginning of a climactic chapter that, in some ways, all of the threads of the book come together in this moment. And just what you need to know in terms of facts, if you haven't read the book yet, I went to school in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That's where Western Kentucky University is. That's Rand Paul's district, if you want some context for what that might have been like. But in this chapter, I'm visiting friends in Phoenix, Arizona, where ASU is located. And in college at that point, I had dreadlocks. So at one point, I mentioned that. So, you know, a different moment. It was like five Rihannas ago. You know, actually, probably 10. Okay. Chapter 15, December 31st, 2007, Phoenix, Arizona. A joke I used to repeat in those days was, why be happy when you can be interesting? I knew how to be interesting. There was power in being a spectacle, even a miserable spectacle. The punch and the line. Interesting. Sentences like serrated blades, laughter like machine gun rounds, a drink in one hand, a borrowed cigarette in the other. If you could draw enough glances, any room could orbit around you. That New Year's Eve, I wound up at a party that was exactly like every party I had ever been to. An iPod hooked up to a pair of speakers, an awkward costume theme I tried and failed to adhere to, and an apartment clogged with white people. The only difference was that I was getting wasted in Phoenix, Arizona, instead of Bowling Green, Kentucky. In the few days I had been there, I had concluded that Arizona was perhaps the whitest place I had ever visited. It was like stepping onto the surface of a very well-lit moon. The party's theme was the future. which is why more than half the people in attendance were wearing some combination of synthetic fabric, aluminum foil, and sunglasses. I hadn't known that there would be a theme, and the only other shirt I had packed was a blue calico button-down. So I put my dreadlocks into two pigtails and kept telling everyone I was Dorothy. No one found this in any way strange because, of course, this was the future. And all bets are off in the year 2075. Over the last few years at college parties just like this one, I had been an ice queen. I had been Play-Doh with a boy dressed as Aristotle in tow. I had been the hot pink negligee all nuns wear under their robes. I'd been Dorothy from Kansas, fake poppy blossoms woven into my dreadlocks. Maybe a theme like the future was supposed to get us to wonder, starry-eyed, what the future would be like. But I couldn't find it in myself. Instead, all I could wonder was whether there would be a future left for any of us. A black man was running to become president of the United States of America, and I was checking the news every morning, anxious, half expecting to read that he had been assassinated. Lately, I had been calling home less. I hadn't even told my mom I was going to be in Phoenix for the holiday. A professor who had known me since I was a freshman confronted me in her office just before the fall semester ended. "What happened to you, Saeed?" she said. "You used to smile." I stared at the professor blankly, then remembered that this was the part where I was supposed to cry. So I cried. This was a future I would have to figure out on my own, but I didn't want to think about it, at least for one more night. I wanted to dance at a huge, messy party and get blackout drunk. In this particular version of the future, I was one of three out gay men at the party. And the other two were dating each other. They're married now. It's trash. But I would find a way. I wanted to spend the night in someone else's body. Or let someone borrow mine. For the first few hours of the party, either I didn't notice him, or the man who would later try to kill me simply had not arrived yet. All night, I was a terrific, bright black mess. I stomped, slinked, sauntered in and out of the kitchen to refill my cup or do shots. I shouted orders about songs that should be added to the party's playlist. Out on the porch, smoking cigarettes, then passing around a blunt, I stared at an orange tree just out of reach until I finally plucked off a fruit. It seemed miraculous. Oranges in the dead of winter. Then I realized the unseen side of the fruit was rotted. Ants pouring out of the ruin like ink. Looking back, I can see how someone might see me that night and argue that I had it coming. That I had a man like him coming. If that someone was America herself, I can understand how she might rattle off a warning. That black boy has been too hungry for too long. One of these nights, he's going to bite off more than he can chew. I will say for myself, America, I did the best I could with what I was given. The man, let's call him Daniel, looked familiar when I saw him from across the room, as if each part of him had been borrowed from some other boy or man I had wanted. Leaning against that wall, dispassionately sipping a beer, he was the kind of quiet I have noticed in certain men and long hungered for. The silence of men who have it all and thus find it all boring. Who don't exert the energy necessary to flirt, persuade, or convince because they know America will come crawling to them on hands and knees. I realize now that what I wanted was not just the bodies of such men, but their power and what they could use that power to do to the rest of us. The brutal exertion of will, destiny made manifest by the unspoken threat their muscled body and white skin posed. I hungered for the power of the all-American man, the Marlboro man, and the Marlboro man's firstborn son, the high school quarterback, the company's future CEO, Ernest Hemingway, John Wayne, Odysseus, Hercules, Achilles, the shield itself, the stone-cut archetype, the goddamned everyman, the golden boy, the one. If I could not actually be the one myself, I thought I could survive by devouring him whole. The more straight, the more masculine, the more I wanted to see him with his legs spread or up, back arched in an orgasm that did not just bring him pleasure, but a warning. In spite of the man you say you are, in the future I live in, men like me are coming to conquer you. And we will take no prisoners. This is what I thought it meant to be a man fighting for his life. If America was going to hate me for being black and gay, then I might as well make a weapon out of myself. Thank you.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How y'all doing? Come on now, Saeed Jones, y'all.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, in preparation, like, I make notes. And it's such an amazing read.
Thank you.
It is gospel. It is holy. It is... It just goes against all convention about how black folks don't tell our secrets and keep stuff hidden. And that stuff turns into other stuff.
Yes, it metastasizes.
Yes, sir. Mm. And you have gone behind the liver, you know, to where these kind of shames hold themselves. Mm. And you have just brought it all out.
Thank you.
And yeah, thank you for this book. I'm curious about this. Let's start with the weaponizing of blackness and gayness.
Sure.
And how you write towards that and where it is, what weapon is it now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the easy answer is the weapon is the work, mm-hmm. the writing. You know, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. Mm. I, as you see on brilliant display in that section, remain disgusted by what America tries to get over on us, mm-hmm. all of us. And how? It disgusts me. It yeah. does. But I think because, as you soon see that night, mm-hmm. you know, I have a wake-up call in the form of this man.
Yeah.
You know, statistically speaking, it would be far more logical for me to have died that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that pretty quickly after surviving it.
Yeah.
And... as you see, and the way I write about that evening, I wanted to make it very clear that I do not deserve what happened to me, mm-hmm. but how I got to that room is an important part of understanding why it all mattered. Mm-hmm. You know, just as much as the violence, just as much as the horror, I wanted to make it clear to readers that look at what America does to us. Mm-hmm. Over time, look at what happens when we become strangers to ourselves. And, you know, you meet Daniel soon after and you see what a wreck he is. And so I wanted to demonstrate on the page what a wreck I was.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I thought I was so angry and my rage was so wild and undisciplined. Mm. Now I think my rage is disciplined
okay.
And artful, hopefully.
Yeah.
But at the time it was just reckless. And so I just... you know, I just wanted to make noise. I wanted America to hear me. I wanted to feel something. I wanted to be felt, even if it was a punch, you know, because I just, it just all felt so perilous. And by that point, you know, the first chapter of the book is like invoking Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. And we can talk about that too. But at that point, I was just kind of exhausted with it in a way that, I mean, you know, with what's going on now, I mean, let's just, let's talk about what it is to be an immigrant here. Let's talk about what it means to have family members who have survived the Holocaust in your lifetime and then are watching what's happening in 2019. Let's talk about black trans women watching the frequency with which their sisters are murdered, and they don't even get to become hashtags, actually.
Right.
Their names don't even go viral, right? They don't become headlines, actually. They're grouped together. We meet them as 30 women have died. You know what I mean? So think about, and I think there's a point where you're just, sure, maybe we reach some kind of self-actualization and, you know, come together and mobilize and write books. But sometimes I think we're just a mess.
Yeah.
And we're angry and we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to show that. As someone who's gotten past it, I felt it was important to show, you know, an earlier iteration of all of this.
Right, that's amazing. I have an ex who would say, you know, after we have exhausted ourselves in a fight, you know, after we have used up all the language, you know, then that signals, like, that's where the story begins.
Yeah.
You know, can you talk about your exhaustion after what America has done to you as a black man, as a gay man, as an artist, as, you know, the product of a single parent household? Like, tell me about that exhaustion, which you took a lot of pride in at one point in your life, like exhausting yourself.
Yeah, you know, I was working so hard.
Right.
Working so hard. I think, you know, I mean, what we realize, I think, is at the end of the exhaustion, it's the end. Like, you can't, it's not the end of your life, but it's the end. Like, it's not creatively generative anymore. You are just repeating the same talking point. Like, you're just kind of like, you know. And I think a lot of people are in that space now. And it's a very vulnerable space to be in, and incredibly dangerous. You know, I think empathy is neutral. So when I say I empathize with people, I'm not trying to say that I agree with them. But I mean, look at these, I call them sentient clan hoods. Look at these people who, whether they realize it or not, 15 years from now, they are all going to be called white supremacists. And the way that when we look at what was going on, you know, in Europe, you know, during World War II, there's no nuance. You're just a Nazi. It doesn't matter your reasons, your economic anxiety, or your, sorry, boo. Hate that is inconvenient for you. You know? So there are a lot of people, I think, in that space. And I think it is, they are exhausted. They've exhausted themselves. The economy's exhausted them. Whatever.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, they're fighting for their lives, but they don't know it.
Yeah.
And I think when you don't think you're struggling, when you know, you just believe, it's like pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you just, any talking point, you know, President Trump hands to you, just you just hold on to it for dear life, you know, even if it, like, he's like, the sky is purple, and you're like, yes, the sky, you know, it's just, there's a cost. And I think that angst and that anxiety, I think they feel it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I think we assume that when people are trying to get something over on us, we'll eventually catch up with them and make them change their minds. Yeah. I don't think that's actually what happens, usually.
Yeah.
It happened with me. But it took someone trying to kill me for me to go, wait a minute, you know? I think most times we just, it turns into wrath.
Yeah.
You know, because isn't it better to just step on someone? You know, in The Bluest Eye, I mean, a true analogy to that scene is in The Bluest Eye with Piccola, and Toni Morrison talks about that moment when Piccola's walking home and she feels anger. As a little girl, she feels anger. And that anger feels like power to her, to this dark-skinned black girl who's being sexually abused, has no power, but briefly she feels something.
Yeah.
And so when I'm like, the goddamn that's what that moment is, you know, and it's incredibly dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous. And I feel that for me to pretend that I was not like that, to just pretend that I was just this perfect victim and I had no idea what was it. It just does such a tremendous disservice to what we're all struggling with.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You're listening to poet, writer, and co-host of AM to DM for BuzzFeed News, Saeed Jones, whose new memoir is How We Fight for Our Lives. He's joined in conversation by theologian and artist Marvin K. White on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Yeah, you make me think. You talked about, you know, this future, you know, that you could not see yourself in.
Right.
You know, if those who are white supremacist adjacent today are white supremacists tomorrow, what about black gay boys, you know, some of whom you mention in the book as your literary ancestors?
Right.
What became of them if this is their future, and what comes of us in the next future?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess to look back, I mean, you know, Texas, where I grew up, is interesting. I'm reading a wonderful book about Lawrence Wright's book. I'm sure a few of you have. It's a wonderful book about the history of Texas. Texas has a disproportionate impact on the Supreme Court for all kinds of reasons. And I would argue, in part, it's very simple. It was once a country. We have a former country in the middle of America that's really large. So it leads to all kinds of important decisions. So one of them, my junior year in high school, is Lawrence v. Texas. That is the law that ended anti-sodomy laws. Hmm. My junior year, that's what, 2003? I made it to my junior year of high school with the understanding that if a police officer somehow saw me having sex with another man and decided to arrest us, that that was legal. To say nothing of the fact that marriage equality was a fantasy at the time. You know, shows like Pose and Steven Universe and, you know, and women like Janet Mock and Laverne Cox and MJ Rodriguez being celebrated on the red. All of that. It's just, I couldn't even fathom it.
Right.
I couldn't even fathom it. But here we are.
Yeah.
And it's not a fantasy anymore.
Right.
Now, America is not exactly doing what I would like for it to be doing right now. You know, that progress is, of course, going on with everything else. But I would like to believe that young queer kids, met some tonight, lovely folks. I would like to think that they get to run a little faster and a little farther and spend a little less time. We all have to do this human work. Everyone, no matter what your identity is, we have to do the work of figuring out who we are. And it is often a real struggle, right? But I would like to think that it's a little less perilous for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then new perils will emerge. That's what it is. But I would like to think, particularly black queer kids, they exist in a space where I can be on stage with you and, like, I can disagree with RuPaul.
Yeah.
I can say I don't agree with his politics. I think he's kind of become very conservative and is kind of abandoning genderqueer and trans women in his embrace of drag, that it's kind of outdated.
Yeah.
And I don't have to go, well, don't say that on stage because we got to show a united front. There are only three of us.
Right.
There aren't only three of us anymore.
Right.
You know, and that's really important. So that is a tangible aspect of diversity. When I was working at BuzzFeed News, I worked there for 6 years. I was like employee 139. I think by the time I left earlier this year, it was like well over, I don't know how many thousands of people. And I remember talking to another black coworker, and we were both executive editors at this point. And she said, you know what progress looks like? I was like, what? And she was like, I just saw some black people in the cafeteria. And not only did I not know their names, I didn't feel the need to walk over there and learn them.
Huh.
You know, like progress is when you get to a space where you go, it's fine.
Wow.
Do your thing.
You know, I do have to tell you, you know, I came out as a black gay writer in the generation of black gay men who were dying from AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we think about people like Asoto Saint who constructed this anthology called The Road Before Us, 100 Black Gay Poets, I really think that he was playing the odds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he could name 100 black gay poets, maybe 4 of us will make it, you know. But it was a greater likelihood that some of us might, mm-hmm. you know. But the thing that also happened, because that was a very physical dealing with the pandemic.
Right.
You know, it was embodied. Mm-hmm. I feel like what was handed off was a psychic scar.
Yes.
You know.
That's an excellent point.
And I wonder if you could talk about how AIDS anxieties and inheriting, you know, this black, gay, you know, impossible future mm-hmm. Impacted your writing and mm-hmm. your self-making.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 33. I was born in 1985. So I would argue that I'm a member of a bridge, in terms of gay men, this bridge generation where, and you see it at the book, yeah. where, because it takes time for, because we don't have sex ed consistently, and certainly in a way that embraces questions relevant to queer people, it takes so long for accurate queer health relevant information to reach young yeah. people. So though, you know, HIV AIDS medication had been introduced, that already, you know, by the time I was a kid, that meant that, you know, getting HIV was not a death sentence anymore. Yeah. I didn't know it.
Right.
By the time I was in middle school, I just assumed, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you're going to be gay, probably half of us are going to get HIV mm-hmm. AIDS, and then half of those people are going to die.
Yeah.
That's just kind of what I assumed.
Yeah.
And then the rest of us will hope we don't end up like Matthew Shepard, to right. be frank. And then, you know, you grow up and you begin to see, like, meeting, you know, older gay men who were HIV positive mm-hmm. and living happily yeah. and productive. And that was, that was to me, as radical and transformative as when I was younger, seeing two men in Dallas, Texas, mm-hmm. in Oaklawn, which is like the gayborhood there, walk down the street in broad daylight holding hands.
Yeah.
And and I followed them down the street. Mm. I was in high school, and I just kept following this couple because it was, I can't explain to you now because, of course, we're, you know, there, so much has changed, but I can't explain to you what it meant at that time in broad daylight to see a happy couple waving to people that they knew, holding hands in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. It was the light that struck Paul on the way yeah. to Damascus.
Yeah.
Everything changed. So I grew up in that context. And then, yeah, I would say men my age, you know, most of our sexual history until literally a few years mm-hmm. ago, every sexual experience was wrapped up in this fear, mm-hmm. maybe not of death, mm-hmm. but of a medical condition that, yeah. that's going to require energy and resources and treatment.
Right.
It's not nothing.
Right.
Right. And now there's PrEP, and congratulations. Gavin Newsom, I think, is making some good decisions on
yeah,
this front.
Very much
okay.
so.
Okay, but introducing PrEP and making it free to people mm-hmm. and making it easier for them to access it, my goodness, that is huge. And I hope that reaches places like the state of Mississippi, mm-hmm. Where black gay men are dying actually, I would argue, probably even more
yeah.
than during the early years of the plague, you know? So all of this is to say, yeah, I'm right in the middle of yeah. this, and I have two white gaybies that I mentor, because I feel like if I can get this right,
yeah.
and because I think they're so bright and fun and wild and loved, that they can impact a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they just haven't had this fear. And it's really interesting to see moments of my anxiety
yeah.
pop up and surprise, even as I, you know, like I've had moments with older, and I'm like, you need to calm down, like yeah. stop, you know, because I think survivor's guilt, it's all very complicated,
yeah.
you know, but I've surprised myself when, you know, I think when you have suffered
mm-hmm.
or lived with, well, fear is a kind of suffering, right? When you have suffered and then you see someone who's a different iteration of you, and they just don't even understand. They are so, that freedom, it is a complicated thing to witness. You are happy mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're jealous.
Yeah.
Of course you're, how could you not be? You know, of course you feel a sense of loss. As someone who, and you see the moment in the book where I'm in graduate school and I'm going through, you know, all of Asado Saint, mm-hmm. Reginald Shepherd, Don Belton, yeah. you know, yeah. just black gay men whose work meant, Essex Hemphill, mm-hmm. whose work meant so much to me. And they were all of them were dead, mm-hmm. if not by HIV, AIDS, poverty, or violence.
Mm-hmm.
Just every single one of them mm-hmm. was dead. And that was really devastating yeah. and kind of paralyzing.
Yeah.
And so it means a lot to me, and I'm going to try to live for a long time. And I hope you do too,
yeah. Yeah.
because I don't want younger writers to experience that.
Right, right. There is, yeah.
Thank you.
you know, we often, you know, when they were dying, when mm-hmm. DeSoto was dying, when Donald Woods was dying, when yeah. Essex was dying, when Joseph was dying, like, it was as if they didn't sign our literary birth certificates.
Right.
So there was like this big, like, we went from being writers with them at their knees to being their caregivers, mm. you know, but we didn't have advanced directive, creative advanced directives set up. Mm. So they couldn't name us. So when we were like, I'm the next Essex,
they were like, are you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was no handing off because it seemingly happened so quick
yeah.
that they were taken away from us. Mm. And this exacting that on another generation of folks, I think you're absolutely right. We cannot afford to do that.
We can't. And listen, it's difficult. Mm. You know, that's why I say, like, that watching mm. that difference, I'm mm. not going to pretend it's always easy and that I always handle it great. My mom and I in the book have a vibrant relationship. Yeah. We're so warm and loving, but sexuality, like my queer, she just couldn't handle it. It was yeah. a silence. And I think she was aware of the fact that she was a good parent yeah. who couldn't do this one yeah. thing. And I think the shame made it even harder. Yeah.
Right.
And there are moments in the book where I like, you know, try to bring up a boyfriend or something in college. And I describe it as like, it's like taking someone who's afraid of heights to the edge of a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we've had that moment where we're particularly as young people with our parents or our grandparents, where we're asking something of them that we need.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that time? You know, and you see the tremendous pain.
Right.
And in that moment, you have to make a decision.
Yeah.
And I think often out of love, we disappear.
Yeah.
We go, okay, I won't do this to you.
We walk it
you
back.
Know? And so it is hard, all of these, this difference, yeah. even with loved ones, even the people who made you, you know? And I just think we need to say it's hard. I think we need to say it's difficult, that we are all students, maybe some more advanced and experienced than others, but we are all students in life. And saying that does not weaken what we're trying to do. Right. You know, moms often come up to me after these events and they talk about, you know, genuinely being afraid
mm-hmm.
for their queer kids
yeah.
and feeling overwhelmed or, you know, I've had so many conversations now with grandmothers yeah. about pronouns.
Oh, my goodness.
And I, you know, and I'm just like, you know, I'm like, I get, yeah, it's new. You know, and I'm just like, I get it. You know, it's new for you. You've lived a long time. You've done a lot. And then all of a sudden, language itself. Think about how basic language is, your understanding of it, and how much it impacts your understanding of yourself and the world. And then people are like, no pronouns. You're like, what? You know, like, I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying that it is not worth it and important. But I do think it's important to go, okay. Let me go through this again. You know, and say like, and I got to tell you, I mess up sometimes too.
Yeah.
And I try to correct myself. Messed up last night at an event, talking about a beloved friend and had to correct pronouns, you know, in the moment. Okay. And I'm glad I didn't wait or any, like, okay, but we love these people and we understand what it means to them.
Yeah.
You want to talk about pronouns? I tell you what, go to one of your bro friends and say, hey girl. Listen, I can't tell you how many times as a young person, and you've probably had this too, you're messing around, and it's like a mixed group of people, and you're just jostling and everything. You say, hey, girl, and the guys go, what are you talking about? Everything changes.
Yeah.
That. They care about pronouns.
Yeah.
Remind them. You know, when they say, oh, I just don't get it. It's just, yes, you do. Yeah. Yes, you do. So we have to do this work. It's important. It's about making people feel safe and welcomed and just known. And, you know, maybe someone will say, what you did really hurt me.
Yeah.
But more times than not, we don't say it. Mm. Right? We keep it to ourselves. We go home and we grieve in private. It becomes a silence. And as I said, right when we sat down, it metastasizes.
Yeah.
So when you see, when I'm reading that part of the book, a terrific bright black mess, that is what it looks like. Years later, you know, there were so many opportunities in the two decades that preceded that moment where maybe we could have done another path and it would have been messy and whatever, but wouldn't it have been worth it?
Right.
You know, and so I think that's, we have to honor that it is work and honor that we love people. Yeah. We love people, don't we? And that this is a way to prove it.
Right. And but you write that so beautifully. Like, did he deserve it? Mm. You know? And if the question is, did you deserve this life, you know, to go through all this to get to this place? Mm-hmm. I say yes. Mm. You know, it's a...
I think yes, too. You know,
yeah, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
In this moment.
Thank you.
Having survived, having done some damage. Mm-hmm. And
it's like what Louis Gluck, I have not always been kind.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about your mom, particularly, you know, as we talk about AIDS, you know, the scene of the picture of her friend falling out of
another country.
Yeah. Of another country. and the registering of attraction to this man, and then hearing the story of insisting you knowing who he was to her. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was one of the first moments that I registered as you being turned on, you know, in front of your, you know, by something through your mother as well. I want to know more about the relationship between you and your mother, how it impacted your sexuality, and, you know, this inching towards trying to tell her, you know, about this sexuality that was coming.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my mom was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Just conventionally, she was really beautiful. She was a model when she was younger. She didn't graduate from college, but she read 3 newspapers a day. The house was just littered with books. You could, like, trip over a book if you weren't careful. And we didn't talk about it, but we were all always reading. You know, that was just, you would be reading, I'd be reading. Mm-hmm. It was just so, and that was really important. And, yeah, she was sophisticated. She had been, we were talking about, my mom worked for Delta Airlines. And through her, I know just a whole kind of legion of black women in their 40s and 50s, 60s. Working class, who from working class origins, but, you know, worked for the airlines and got to see the world,
right?
And the way that informed them, you know. And my mom was certainly one of. She traveled everywhere before I was born, you know. And so, though she's living paycheck to paycheck as I'm growing up as a kid, and at that point she's a gate agent at the DFW airport. She'd seen a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was funny. Today I had Japanese beef curry at my hotel, and it was so good. And I was starting to have like a really like, I wasn't crying, but I was like, this is more than a good meal. And I was like, oh, my mom made this.
Oh my goodness.
Because she would study Japanese recipes. Mm-hmm. That wasn't unusual. She would study Mexican cuisine. She was all, you know, so we just grew up in a very cosmopolitan household. So, you know, and my mom, the other thing, and my mom practiced Nichiren Buddhism. Mm-hmm. She chanted Nam-myoho Renge Kyo and named me Saeed in reference to it, a fortune baby, which is, the idea that if your mother was chanting when you were born, you're like endowed with fortune. So she named me Saeed, which in Arabic means happy and fortunate. You know, so that was the joyful crucible, you know, I lived in. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of sexuality, in terms of my confidence, and I don't mean just like necessarily self-confidence, but like asserting myself, that kind of like, you got to like see. Yeah. And what I read, I think I got it from her because she was just such a commanding person, and I saw how people were drawn to her. I saw how she was vulnerable, and you know, she had her insecurities too, but I think she was pretty good about being like, you don't get what's going on here, that's a you problem. You know, and like I would be like, that's a you problem, okay, you know, like trying to like mimic it, you know. So I think I inherited that from her, and it took me a while. Because I didn't think I was beautiful. Right. I didn't think I was handsome in the way that I perceived my mother. Mm-hmm. I described her as my first diva.
Yes.
You know, so there's a sense of distance there. Actually, I had a very mean middle school teacher, middle school history teacher, who was responsible for being the first teacher to teach me about slavery. So buckle up. He was a jerk.
Put his name out there.
Yeah. His name was like, I eventually learned his name was Manyard, and I started teasing him, and I got detention for calling him Manyard because of what I'm about to say. But Manyard, I can't remember. You loser, I don't even remember your last name. Anyway, we never got along. I was always like not raising my hands, and history, as I was talking to the students tonight, like the way history is taught in public schools is so politicized and so deceptive. And I think I didn't totally understand, but I felt something was wrong, you know, and so I was always kind of pushing back. when he would be talking about slavery and be like, well, some slaves were, I kind of have them like, So parent-teacher conference happens. My mom comes, and I'm so excited because I'm like, bad bitch, yes. Hot. My mom was like the original hot girl summer, you know? And she came in, and I remember he was stunned.
Yeah.
She walked in, and I remember, you know, seeing the way men go, you know, that happened. And I was so proud, and then it went on, and he was so nice and whatever. And I was like, And I went into class the next day, and I was so excited for once to go to history class because, and I think he knew it. And he walked up to me when, you know, people are trickling in, sitting at their desks, and he said, your mom is so beautiful. Hmm. And before I could say thank you, he said, what happened to you? Yeah, deeply hurtful. So I draw attention to that because it just feels like all of this was just like swirling around. And I think he was like eighth grade history teacher, which like, gosh, what a time. What a, you know, your hormones alone are just crazy. Yeah, but that's, it was all kind of going on at once.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is poet, writer, and co-host of AM to DM for BuzzFeed News, Saeed Jones, whose new memoir is How We Fight for Our Lives. He's joined in conversation by theologian and artist Marvin K. White. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And it's funny, I when I was in Austin for the Texas Book Festival, I got to see my 7th and 8th grade English teacher. We stayed in touch, and she's wonderful. She was always so kind. Her name is Roxanne Villarreal. She was just wonderful. And I was like, what was I like? And she was like, you couldn't understand just how bright you were. Like, that you had this like energy, and it was just like a matter of like how was it going to kind of shake out. But you just, and I was like, so could you tell I was gay? And she was like,
with that face, you did it? That's, well, you know, I think the way you wrote about this very real woman, like you said earlier, not a literary device. She is up there with Setha and Baby Suggs to me. You fleshed her out, and that could only be from a son. My therapist called me a spousified child, too. I was my mama's little man.
Okay, so man of the house.
Man of the house, you know. So you had to be that close to pay that much attention to get these details about her down. Tell me about studying her, like you just, you know.
I mean, yeah, I certainly was studying her in the moment, you know, and it was complicated and sometimes painful, right? Yeah. Like, and what happened to you? And I knew exactly what he meant. It was the perfect dagger. But, you know, as a writer, and in part because, you know, my mom passed away in 2011. It's the last act of the book. The book's in four acts. She had a heart attack the night before Mother's Day in 2011, which it just was so awful. And just the way it unfolds, you know, going to visit her, it was all so awful and over the top that in addition to grief just being like this, you always are like, this can't be happening. I really felt like this can't be happening. But it was a part of the book because then it was like, it's time for you to fight for your life. So recognizing that nothing is more vulnerable. I mean, I'm sure it's so funny. People on my dad's side of the family were like, why aren't we in the book? What? And I was like, read the book. You'll thank me. I was like, no one should want to be in a memoir. Not at least not written by Saeed Jones. You don't want it. You don't want it. You know, please don't end up in my book. Because I go there. I am always going to go there. I believe, as I've said over and over again tonight, that that is a part of the work. And I believe that it is worth the uncomfortableness. With my mom, though, I was like, well, gosh, nothing's more vulnerable than dying, right? It's the absolute loss of control. And I'm going to have to write about that experience. So I tried to, like, how can I do the entire narrative arc in a compassionate way, knowing that eventually so much is going to be taken from her as a character. Knowing that, oh my gosh, it is just all, you're going to see her, you know, in a coma.
Yeah.
that, you know? So when she first appears in the novel, it's via poem mm-hmm. that opens the book. And it's very clear that she's like, she's not your mom. She's a woman
yeah.
dancing to Prince. You know, I wanted to, from the very beginning, establish that she had a life of her own that was as rich and as vibrant, as important as her life as my mother. Just from the jump, just know that. And then in the first prose chapter, yeah. when she walks in, she kind of walks in and immediately kind of walks out.
Yeah,
I have a really important question about that photograph. And she's right. like, right. and gone. So, because I was trying to just signal to readers, right. you know, she had a long day of work. Mm-hmm. Think about what that would be like, right. just to have a long, challenging day of work. Think about the commute home. Mm. Think about how damn hot it is in Texas in May. It's so hot.
And that glass of water uh-huh. every day.
And you then know. You walk home to your gay son who has this like really urgent question about sexuality and health. You know, like that's kind of a lot. Yeah. I would be tired too, you know? So I want, yeah, exactly. Yeah. She needs to smoke a cigarette yeah. first. Like, can yeah. you chill, please? Right. And so I felt like that was a way of coloring her humanity yeah. and like, sure, it would have been great if the moment I asked, like, who is this man? Mm-hmm. Why did, because basically I find a photograph of a dude that I don't know and I show it to her and she's like, oh, I've been looking for that. It was a friend of mine. And I'm like, well, what's up? And she's like, we did road trips and everything. And I'm like, she's being very vague. And she's like, well, eventually he found out he got sick and he killed himself. And she just walks out of the room. Mm. She goes to get another glass of wine. And I'm like, what? Right. And she hasn't even said, she never told me his name. I still don't know.
Oh.
I still don't know his name. I don't know anything else about this. We never talked about that man again.
Hmm.
Talk about silence. But as she's walking away, I said, because I'm like, what does being, he looks young, he was healthy in my appearance, you know, in his appearance. What does being sick have to do with killing yourself? Mm-hmm. So I just turned and I say, why did he kill himself? And she just said, AIDS, and closed her bedroom door.
Hmm.
You know, so that's the moment. So like, sure. Sure, it would have been great if my mom had said, well, let's talk about HIV/AIDS. Let's talk about the relationship between mental health and physical health. Let's have a whole, let me tell you his name and everything. Right. Let me tell you what it was like, you know, in the years before you were born in 1985. Mm-hmm. But she was exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And where's the blueprint for that conversation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are you ready to step up to the moment? And I don't, you know, I don't know if I would have right. done much better either. So I just tried to be true to what happened, but also make space for us to understand, not mm-hmm. letting people off the hook, but thinking about the why,
yeah.
and to honor the work, you right. know, so that when we do break through, we're like, yeah, we did it, you know. Right. And then also just the last thing that was really important to me for my mom and my grandmother, my mom, a black single mom. Mm-hmm. You know, working paycheck to paycheck in the South, I just really wanted to fight off the thought bubbles mm-hmm. of stereotypes that can overtake that kind of mm-hmm. woman and that kind of character. And like my grandmother, a very religious and politically conservative mm-hmm. black woman who's lived in Memphis, Tennessee her whole life, thought bubble, you know, and I was like, she doesn't like to cook. It's not like the grandma from Soul Food. She's not a storyteller. Like that's, you know, she's actually really quiet and actually surprisingly Midwestern, though. She's a Southerner.
Yeah.
So I was trying to, I guess what I'm trying to say is navigate all of those things, because it just felt like, how could I write this book that's about my struggle yeah. and the book become a struggle for someone else?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you, again, you do it wonderfully and beautifully. And you, even the most cruel person in the book, you write them into a humanity. Like, you know that they're just working out their own stuff.
Mm.
You know, your grandmama.
Mm. Going through stuff.
Yeah.
Going through stuff.
You know, I don't know if you read the book, but there was some, you know, the scene that just struck me was the prayer scene where, you know, you realize at some point in the summer that the person at church that they're trying to save from hell is you,
mm-hmm.
you know. Right. Where are my cousins?
Yeah.
You know, it was.
I was like, everyone's not going to church 5 days a week? That's just me?
Right. You know, and then the cursing
yeah.
of your mom. Mm-hmm. And they were calling it a prayer.
But it was a curse.
It was a curse, mm-hmm. you know, and how that registered and inked itself on you. Can you talk about?
Yeah, I mean, you can read the book, or you have. You know, I think it's a difficult part of the book for me because it is actually a moment where, in my grandmother's case, as a caregiver, right? Someone raising me. She is trying,
mm-hmm.
right? Like to try to save someone's soul, that seems like a pretty urgent, sincere act as far as I understand it, you know? That is an act of love. But sometimes when we're doing the work, when we are doing something out of love, America can mangle that loving gesture into another harm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandmother basically took me to the front of the church and was like, my grandson, this is my grandson Saeed from Texas, and his mother was Buddhist. And that was it. And the pastor, who of course didn't know me, definitely didn't know my mom, you know, instead of saying like, oh God, you know, show him your love, help him understand, you know, that's one way it could have gone. You know, I probably still wouldn't have been persuaded, but he could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
But instead he was like, you know, one of your children has strayed from the light and decided to take her son with her. And I was so overwhelmed because we're at the front of the, you know, I was like, I could barely understand what he was saying. And then he said, make her suffer. And I just, yeah, I mean, I just, you know, and listen, you know, writing a memoir is crazy because you have to create dialogue and mm-hmm. do all of these, use all of these fictive elements to, you know, try to tell the truth, right? And so you're asking a lot of readers, right? And so dialogue is, you know, it's a reconstruction.
Right.
I remember exactly what that man said. I will always remember yeah. what he said. And he's just like, make her suffer and show her your plagues and, you know, every illness and ailment upon her so that she will, you know, just realize that she's gone off and needs to come back and bring him with her. Wow. What a twisted,
yeah.
Warped, disturbing perception of the God you believe in.
Right.
You know? I mean, this is... What? And it just... So it was so awful. And of course, I'm kneeling holding my mother's mm-hmm. hand. And so I'm just like, kind of look at her. Like, are you hearing this?
Right.
You know? It was so awful. Because it was deeply hurtful, but doubly so. Because I really do feel... And listen, my grandmother's read the book.
Yeah.
I asked her what she thought about the first third. And she just said it brought back a lot of memories.
Oh, wow.
You know, she didn't... And that's where that scene takes place. Like, she is never... Like, when, in graduate school, my mom called me and was like, you know, I told mom you said you want to write a memoir one day. And I had to explain what that is. And I, like, froze in my steps on the phone. And I was like, well, what did she say? Uh-oh. you know, and as I've noted, my grandmother is a pretty terse woman. So note that she's not apologizing.
Mm.
She's not making excuses. She's not saying, well, Saeed didn't just you just didn't understand.
What, mm.
You know, not reframing, not trying to get it. You know, and I talked to her a couple of times while I was writing the book, and she would just listen.
Mm.
But she trusted me. She yeah. trusted me. She didn't say, please don't write that book. She didn't say, well, what are you going to, you know, show it to me?
Yeah.
She just said, okay, you know? And so I sent her the galley before it went out because mm-hmm. I was like, listen, I sent it to her, my Uncle Albert, who you see a bit in the
yeah.
book as well, the stand-up man.
Yes, sir.
Good guy. And my mom's sister, Celia. And, you know, just because I was like, listen, I was like, let me be very clear. What happened, happened. If you wanted something different to happen, then you should have acted differently. That's yeah. how I feel. Yeah. You know, I'm the Mary Carr school of, you know, writing about family members. But I was like, I need you to trust that I wrote this with compassion because
yeah.
I did. I worked really hard. So I was like, I'm sending this to you because I don't want strangers reading about you before you do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't want you, you know, getting a call from one of your church friends being like, oh, so-and-so, my grandson was in San Francisco and did you hear?
Yeah.
You know, no, I want you to, you know, and you can call me and we can talk. And we did.
Yeah.
And we had really warm, deep, powerful conversations.
Yeah.
Because of the book,
yeah.
you know. And so I felt, you know, deeply honored that my grandmother handled and continues to handle what has happened and the book. I mean, my grandmother was devastated.
Mm-hmm.
It remains devastated.
Yeah.
I know that. I've seen her... It was a blow.
I miss that
watching
girl.
Her youngest.
Mm-hmm.
I miss that girl so
mm-hmm.
much. I miss that woman.
I miss that woman. Yes.
I miss that woman. She
yeah.
said to me on the phone about 2 years after my mom died. Whew, you know, but I felt that though I have no problem going there when it's about me, as you see, right? Like, we'll all go there. I felt with them, they trusted me. Yeah. They didn't try to control the story. Yeah. They didn't try to run crisis PR or anything. Yeah. And they certainly didn't ask for this book to be written in this way.
Right.
And so I felt that I needed to do right by them. Just one, because that's the right thing to do. And I'm writing a book about, in some ways, ethics, right? And so I need to try to do it in an ethical way.
Yeah.
But also... that is it. That is it.
I think as Black gay boys, showing up into families that have never seen,
think they haven't.
Mm. But definitely, you were the first to show up. You like SIE.
Like this.
Yes, yes. And I sometimes, you know, at my most compassionate, like they didn't know if they needed to beat their story into us or love their story into us, but they knew that we were going to hold the story, you know, and they got it in our skin and in our body the best ways that they, with the tools that they had. And I think you are telling her story in ways that she probably couldn't even imagine.
I would like to think so. I mean, I don't want you to read this book and go, she's just awful, or God, his mom, or his mom is such a tragic figure, which is probably like the real risk with my mom. You know, I want you to go, wow, they tried really hard, and it still was difficult. And wow, you know, and that's why it's how we fight for our lives. I don't want you to read about me and my family and go, gosh, those folks, it's just so hard for them. And then you're like, okay, no. It's everything's in conversation with your reality and your personal history. And that is true if you see parallels, you're like, oh God, I felt that way too, you know? And the parallels can be very unexpected. That's not necessarily an identity parallel. Or difference. I've never felt that way. Yeah. I've never, my grandmother and I, we talk about everything. Yeah. Awesome. Then appreciate that relationship and know that it's not like that for everyone. You know, I really want it to be this conversation. One, because I feel like it's my attempt, particularly in that that litany of all the, like, kind of the white male cultural canon, you know, a way of explaining that this book is not like a small part of the American story. Yeah. I believe that if you want to better understand America, I'm a pretty good door to walk through.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Y'all need to buy this book. You need to read this book. If you are living today, you were in a fight and you fought to get here. So you're either getting beat up, but you need to know after reading this book that you are in a fight. And there is a way to fight your way through it. And it doesn't matter if you are Black, gay, straight, this is a book that will show you all you need to do to survive in this country. And one more time for Saeed Jones, everybody.
Thank you.
Oh my God, beautiful.
Thank you. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was poet, writer, and co-host of AM to DM for BuzzFeed News, Saeed Jones, whose new memoir is How We Fight for Our Lives. He was joined in conversation by theologian and artist Marvin K. White. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Foltz, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.